Hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and very glad to be with you as we talk about more subjects this week that you guys are passionate about. We love it when you guys write to us and say, oh my goodness, I can't believe you talked about this on the podcast because that's exactly what I was thinking about this week, or this is exactly what God was teaching me as I was reading scripture. We get excited about that. So tell us if God's been teaching you anything related to our inbox question, which is a woman's concern about sharing a bed with her husband when she gets married. Whoa, where's that in the Bible? I don't know. We'll see. Maybe you guys can find it for us. But Jackson Dunn, our director of marriage, weighs in on that and does a very good job giving some practical solutions for how this woman can approach that. For our culture segment, I'm interviewing Jonathan Last. He is the senior writer at the Weekly Standard, the magazine, as well as the author of What to Expect When No One's Expecting. And we're going to talk about demographics around fertility and childbearing globally. So a lot of great info there and really some stunning statistics as well as stunning trends that I think are going to show where we are going as a generation and what we can do as a result. Our show this week is actually sponsored by the Focus Leadership Institute. We love them over there. And we want to make sure that we give a shout out to all of our college students. If you feel the Lord is calling you to leadership, you definitely need to consider the Focus Leadership Institute. They will help you develop those skills in a semester here doing that. Here in Colorado, can you really go wrong? I mean, let's be honest. They will tell you that it changes everything. And from the people that we've had as our interns and the people that we've heard from, even in our boundless audience who have gone, that definitely seems to be the case. So make sure that you apply to be part of the fall semester right now. Go to focusleadership.org. All right, we're going to kick off the show with our roundtable as we always do. There are three of us here in the studio. I have Martha here to my right. Hey, Martha.
Hello.
I don't know why y'all are just wearing black, because that's very depressing. Martha and our guest, Melissa Tempest. Hey.
Hi.
How's it going? Good. Great. And two blondies. I'm in here with two blondies.
It's true. So we actually shouldn't be wearing black. Right. But
that's okay. Whatever. It looks good. And you guys have like spotlights on your heads. So that's just very cherubic. I like that. So.
Me too.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about, we love it when we can come up with discussion topics related to emails that we receive from you guys. So one of those was from a young woman who wants to talk about service and one, how we can kind of get our thoughts and our mindsets and our attitudes off of ourselves, which we all need to do, whether we're single or married or what our age is. We're all just naturally selfish people. Sorry to inform you. But also, then what are some great ways that we can do that? What are just some good ideas for serving? Not only one of those, you know, throw it on the wall and see if it sticks, one-time service opportunities, but to really get into the lives of people where you can make a difference and where you can represent Christ in your community. And so we're going to get down and dirty with that with some practical examples. So as we begin the conversation, let's start by just talking about how this has played out in our own lives. Did you guys have some point, and I'm asking this rhetorically because I'm guessing that the point is no, or the answer is no. So begin
let's
by saying
see.
No. Yeah, let's see. I mean, there aren't many of us that sit around and have this like great awakening in our lives where we're like, you know what, maybe I need to just go out and serve more. And I'm going to start on Wednesday and I'm going to just Google some opportunities or whatever. Most of us have probably slid into something or heard something inspirational or met someone who was doing something and we're like, we want to be a part of that. So let's talk about our own little like wake up calls and opportunities to move into service and how that's kind of played out over the last, you know, the recent years.
Sure. That sounds great. Well, for me, I was supposed to be going to vet school to become a veterinarian, and I was in a five-year program doing my master's of public health and veterinary medicine, and the public health degree really opened my eyes to how much I just love working with kids and global health and issues around children and how they can have a thriving, healthy life. And so I applied to medical school. I didn't get in, but I knew serving animals was not my life's passion. So I gave that up, told the vet school, no, I'm sorry, I'm not coming. And had been really praying, God, what do I do with my time here in the United States, in my community? And medical school obviously isn't the thing, but I just really prayed about it and used my giftings that in public health and my also creativity. I'm a designer, marketer, and photographer, and thought, what do I do with the rest of the time that I'm here? I usually go on medical trips, maybe one or two a year. So what do I do with the rest of the 48 weeks a year that I'm here. Sometimes I think that we feel like God just opens doors that we never knew were there before, but I think the doors are already there. We have to be looking for them, and finally when we're ready to say yes to what God has to offer, we can walk through them. So for me, I knew that I wanted to do more, and so I started working with a local church, a big local church, working with their local ministries department, and they really embraced me to come in and use my creativity, my analytical skills, my desire to work with healthcare and to work with children. And so I've gotten really involved with that.
You know, Lisa, you're kind of making fun of the idea of Googling volunteer opportunities. But I actually think that's not a bad idea. It really takes intentionality to find what are the opportunities out there. And I think a lot of times you have to even do an application to volunteer. So a little intentionality isn't a bad idea.
Yeah. I think it's also...
You can find out what's available. I mean, what is in your community, you know, because where you are is the best place to serve.
I think it's also just speaking to people and just having conversation with people when you can say, I love doing photography. I love working with kids. I love, no matter what it is, there's going to be opportunities you didn't even know about, and people will be able to plug you in. So I think it's in unintentional or intentional networking with other people that you can say, these are my giftings, or these are my passions, or these are my abilities. And it doesn't seem like it's a service project or something that someone could use, but there's always organizations that could use skills or maybe experiences you had that you never thought would come into practice some other time.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about, because everyone here, you know, I talked a little bit about in my introduction about our inherent selfishness. I think all of us have it. And I think the longer we're single, the more we realize how we really do parse out our time and we create space for ourselves. And, you know, we've interviewed parents on the show who are just like, you know, time for myself. What is that? As single people, we have the ability to craft that time and craft our schedules really around that. And so, you know, there's the opportunity, anything from short term, you know, smaller bite size or chunk things like giving up a week or 2 weeks of vacation to do a missions trip. And some people have done that, to doing something consistently over time. What have you guys found to be like, how have you done that, whether on, you know, on different levels or whatever? And what have you found has worked for you? And maybe what have been some of the pain points in that? Like, what have you had to give up?
There was a time where I actually volunteered at a pregnancy center for about 2 years, and it was Monday nights that I would just drive there after work, and really I was only there for about an hour and a half because then they closed at 7, but I enjoyed that just consistency of every Monday night. I knew that's where I would be, so it worked out well that you could plan on it. It mm-hmm. wasn't necessarily a total surprise.
Mm-hmm. I work with an organization called Royal Family Kids Camp, and I'm on leadership for that. And so we take foster children to camp every summer. So we know that the people that we have coming with us, it's one counselor for every two children. We know that that is a week that people are giving up out of their schedule, and they maybe only have 3 weeks of vacation. But for me, I've crafted my life so that I do freelance work. So therefore, I can always say, I'm committing that week. And it's not just the week. It's a banquet. It's team meetings. It's interviewing 50 people to be counselors. It's all of that. But the end goal of that and loving those children and community transformation makes it all worth it. And the time doesn't seem like it's a burden at all, because it's living in my grace. It's living in the grace of what I know to be true about these children, what I know about people who want to be involved. So it's crafting opportunities for people to serve. And that is a beautiful thing. That is what keeps us motivated and our leadership team. And it's not just me on the leadership team. It's a couple who have three children, and it's a young married couple, and they're all serving and love it. But they know that there's sacrifices running their kids around. Maybe for me, it's time that I can't work, or it's just giving up other things that might be fun. But this is really fun for me because of what the end goal is.
Now I have to interrupt here. I think it's awesome that Melissa, I mean, you're able to freelance and have flexibility with your time and stuff. But at the same time, I'm thinking, I could never do that. That just feels like so unstable, and like you can't count on your paycheck. And I mean, how did you get over that? Or do you think it's a personality thing?
I think it's a personality thing. I graduated from college with a degree in pre-veterinary medicine and fine arts. So I used both sides of my brain with creativity and science. So organic chemistry, and then I'd run over to pottery class, and then I'd go over to physics, and then I'd run over to genetics class, and then life drawing. So it's a personality thing for sure. I love being able to meet with people, but my networking through freelance has also opened up doors for me to serve. And so rather than after not getting into medical school and giving up vet school, rather than just saying, oh, now I don't have a profession that I wanted, I decided to ask myself, what do I want my life to look like? What are the important things to me first? It's like that little story about filling a glass with rocks first and then pouring the sand in. So putting the important things in first and then filling in the details. For me, that's what it has been. So there are other people that are, and it's not just Royal Family Kids Camp that I'm working in. It's the Dream Centers of Colorado Springs. So that's a women's healthcare clinic. It's an organization called the Joel Home, which serves young boys who haven't been adopted out of foster care. It's eventually Mary's Home for single homeless moms and their children. So it's things like that that we come around these people that have either had poor choices made for them, they've made poor choices, they've been hurt, maybe they don't know what healthy family is, maybe they don't know how to make good choices for their lives. And so it's coming alongside those people. And there's opportunities, whether you're freelance or not. I was serving with Young Life when I was working 50 hours a week with a full-time job. That was difficult, but it was great because I had something that I felt like I was pouring back into and making a difference in the lives of the teens that I was working with.
Yeah. I think something that's also so valuable, you know, as I think of this, is doing something that you already love to do or something that you're already doing and make it count. You know, like I know a guy who loves to rock climb, and he thought, what better way to incorporate my love of rock climbing with my love of kids than to take some boys who don't have dads, who don't have, and just start teaching them rock climbing. My brother-in-law did that with kung fu and jiu-jitsu, you know, black belts in both of those. And he started a kung fu class for boys and, you know, threw out all the Eastern meditation and all that nuttiness and used scripture memory as a way of focusing, like using the mental discipline for that. And it's something that he wanted to keep up and something that he did and he loved. And he's like, why not, you know, why not incorporate that? I know I, not that I love it, but I run. And so I love getting together with friends, and my friends, coworkers, and I just did a run where we picked a great cause and did, you know, ran as a team. And we had the chance to train a little bit together and get excited about that and build relationships with them. You know, many of them not believers, and be part of that. And so, it's just something where, you know, we can maximize our time instead of we're so just like isolated in the things that we do. We think, you know, I'm going to go. And I mean, if you're spending 2 hours in the gym each day, find a better way to do that, you know, people, or go find someone, you know, that you can work out with or that you can bring alongside you, or and do something that you love. You know, a friend and I both decided that we're both passionate about old people. We just love old people and see how many. I mean, you guys know that my mom is now in assisted living, and I just, I want to make sure that, you know, are there people that care about her? Does she love the staff there? Is she making friends? Is she, I'm 1,000 miles away and I can't visit her every night. And so, you know, there are people in my community, you know, who need that and who don't have family members and who I can go and visit and do that. And I'm thinking of, with my friend, starting a more concerted effort towards that and doing something consistently. After I finish this book, you guys, please pray me through it, because I need to finish it. But that's where when it's going to become concerted. But yeah, I mean, it's just something that I love. And I'm like, so like, I need to get out there and do that.
I think that's great. I think that's what the energy is behind serving. It's not just saying I'm going to check a box, I'm going to put my stamp my time card. Mm-hmm. It's saying I love doing it anyway.
Soldier through this hour of volunteering.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that's sustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's not just something you're passionate about that leads to great service. It's saying, what are my strengths? What is my identity? Who did God really make me to be? Not just, I'm meant to serve. That's great, but that's just too much of a blanket statement. I think doing things like the Strengths Finder test and finding out, what are my strengths? What am I good at? Why do certain things bring me to life, and why can I keep serving through that? And also focusing on something, and it doesn't have to be only doing one thing. For me, I think my main motivation through all of the areas in which I serve is community transformation and saying people are not lost causes. They maybe have to start 25 steps behind where we are, or maybe farther, or they've just gone off on a path that's not healthy. But how can we help them maybe transform their lives 2 years from now, a year from now, 10 minutes from now, 20 years from now? It's a legacy changer. Mm-hmm. And that's really, rather than just complain, this is what motivates me, rather than just complain about people who are maybe in prison and why did they get there, let's back up from there and say, where in their timeline and in their lifespan can I come in and be the hands and feet of Christ? Where can I do that? Do I love children? Well, how do I serve? And at least that was just great that you said that about rock climbing or running, or there's ways that you can just come alongside people. We know how encouraging it is to have someone come and just 1 minute say a great word to us and be encouraging. And that's where service really comes to life.
You know, another way that I've heard that you can kind of discover what your passion is what makes you angry. Mm-hmm. And for you, it might be seeing people, you know, in prison and like, why did that happen? Where did they lead to that? You know, one thing for me is abortion, quite frankly, makes me angry. And that is what motivates me to be involved in that cause. So, you know, if you're not sure, okay, I love this and that, you know, but what cause do I plug into? Just think, what makes me angry? What would I like to change?
Here in Colorado Springs, I think we're really fortunate because there are so many ministries and they're doing so many amazing things. And there's also great conferences. So whether you're here in Colorado or not, there's national conferences. There's Q Conference with Q Ideas. What changes community? There's the Life and Justice Conference that we just had here a few months ago. And like Martha said, what makes you angry? What makes you so frustrated at injustice being done? Or what makes you cry? What is bringing your heart to life that is God's heart for his people? And I know that sounds lofty or weighty, but I know that we are all probably searching for, hoping for more. What can I pour myself into? Where I like to say, getting my hands dirty for Christ, that it's just loving the people around you. So our mission field should be from our heart outward. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with going on mission trips overseas. I love doing that. I love serving overseas, but I think it also... in reality, most people are not going to be full-time missionaries over in Africa or in Asia. And so therefore, how do we spend our time wisely and beautifully here in our community?
Well, and I think too, I mean, again, you know, just practically speaking, what are you good at? You know, I mean, I think for me, it's like if I sit down and I'm like, oh, I probably should be a math tutor. No, I shouldn't, because I can't even
no, you
do
shouldn't.
Math. You know, I can't do it. You know, I mean, that's like ridiculous. But I can, from 12 years in the PR media relations world, I can write a news release for an organization that needs that done. And I could do that in 15 minutes. You know, that is easy for me. That is something that they would have to pay hundreds of dollars to get a professional to do. I could do that. That's something I could step in and do, you know, or play, you know, a game with someone. You know, I love games and stuff like that. Have game nights, do that kind of thing. Get in, you know, go into, like I said, you know, an assisted living or a nursing home and do that. And some friends and I did that for a while, had a lot of fun. But just stuff like that, you know, you look at, I have another friend who is a CPA, and he goes into a community kind of, they run a food bank, they run a shelter, they do different things, and they provide tax services to people. And so he volunteers his time doing that because he could do it in his sleep, you know, and it's just such a great service. And so I think often, you know, we set this bar so high of like, if I need to learn how to cook meals for 200 people so I can start doing the well, you know what? I probably won't be doing that anytime soon. I can't cook meals for one person. So why don't I do something I can do? You know, so I don't know. It just seems to make sense. But I don't know. Any other ideas you guys have practically for where people can find opportunities or how they could kind of transition into something that, you know, maybe they'd get passionate about or understand that?
I think Martha had a great idea looking on, you know, Googling it, looking on the website. I think finding out what things maybe you're even jealous of when you hear someone talk about some opportunity or some way that they're serving, and you think, well, how do I get involved? Or how can I, maybe you just find an organization in your hometown or your community that you feel is doing things that you would like to be part of. And maybe they don't have something posted on their website, but you say, hey, I'm here. These are my skills. Maybe you're passionate about abortion or small children or mentoring or whatever it is. And just go say, I'm willing to offer this. And I wanted to say, too, I do volunteer a lot, but I work freelance, so there's a balance there. But a lot of my volunteering has led to different employment opportunities. So the National Office for Royal Family Kids Camp hired me to rewrite their curriculum with a great group of people passionately involved in Royal Family to help them with that. And that was just amazing. And I wasn't begging at their door for that. I didn't know they were going to ask me to do that, but it's been a great opportunity. So there, you don't just have to feel like you have to become destitute to serve other people, but we are blessed to be a blessing. And I think that's just a beautiful overflow of our heart. And part of the alternative is, what do we do with our free time otherwise?
And I really don't know if I have any good advice, because this is, I mean, really right now, this is something that I'm wanting to do and carve out the time and just do it. Like, that's probably the advice I'd give myself of just, you know what? You can give up your time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of mornings just reading, you know? Yeah. And I have time to give, so I want to find ways.
You need to go read at the public library to little kids. Be Miss Martha. Reading the kids' corner. I'm just saying.
That could be fun.
There's also, you can
bring your bag of tricks.
Yeah. Memorial Hospital, you can go read to kids and then give them books. So that's a really fun way to serve.
Cool. We're going to find something for Martha to do.
We will.
The other thing is, and you know, again, we talk so much about programs and time and all this kind of stuff, but the biggest thing in this equation is relationship and to form relationships with people. And I think one thing that I've started doing is, and again, I've lamented this on the show before, how I feel like I'm always caught up in a Christian ghetto. I'm working here at Focus on the Family. I do stuff with my church. I'm in small groups. I'm in Bible studies. And so for me to even get to know people who don't know the Lord is a huge challenge. But what I can do and what I'm doing now is looking into whether it's a running club or a hiking club or painting or something like that, and then get to know people there and find out what they volunteer in and find out what they're passionate about. And then you can build that connection with them and get involved, you know. And what better way to work side by side with someone who's maybe volunteering for another reason entirely, altruistic as it may be, but you have the opportunity to say, you know, I'm here because I'm passionate about Jesus Christ and about doing what he's called me to do, and I want to get to know you in the process. And so it's kind of a great way to find that out and be part of that. So anyway, cool stuff. Well, thanks you guys for weighing in with ideas. Thanks, Melissa, for sharing your experience. And of course, we wish you all the best in your many things you're doing with
the
camps.
You.
And hopefully you can update us on that as you go along. And good insights, too, just about the perspective of being a freelancer and someone who's doing that. And still, so there's no excuses, people, still has time to carve that out and find out how that works. And Martha and I, we can't just say that we do the Boundless Show as our means of helping the community.
It is a ministry.
It is. Yeah. It is, especially when I have to share stuff about myself that I don't want to share. But, you know, it's okay. There are other things that we can get involved in as well. So, great conversation, you guys.
Thanks. Thank you.
Well, hey, everyone. For this week's culture segment, I am very pleased to have with me in the studio Jonathan Last. He is a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, but decided to come west to talk to us today. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Very glad to have you. Many of you know Glenn Stanton. He's one of our occasional bloggers. Is he out there on the other side of the glass listening in? I have to give him a hard time because, you know, sometimes he blogs for us, sometimes he doesn't. But anyway, I call him out on that. But he brings in great folks, sociologists, researchers, other folks to kind of share findings with us here at Focus on the Family and kind of illustrate where the culture is, where it's going. And Jonathan is no exception. He is the author of What to Expect When No One's Expecting. Love that title. Subtitled America's Coming Demographic Disaster. If you guys think you know what this is about, you basically don't. So I will just start out and tell you that, which is why we have him here today to kind of shed some light on what really we're looking at as a nation here in the U.S., but also globally, because we have a large global audience as well. So all of you out there in Europe and in Australia and Africa and beyond, listen up, because you are not exempt in this. I love on the cover of the book as well. An endorsement or a portion, a quote from PJ O'Rourke says, a powerful argument that the only thing worse than having children is not having them. So any of you that have read Steve and Candace Waters, whom we love here at Focus on the Family and at Boundless, Candace being our founder, know that they are passionate about not only moving you all towards marriage as we are, but giving you inspiration for having babies as well. And so I think Jonathan's going to probably show up in that stable. So anywho, sorry about the long preamble, people, but I just had to go there. So, okay, we're going to start talking here because Jonathan actually spoke this morning. I think I alluded to that here at Focus on the Family. And in addition to kind of really illustrating some of what's in his book, which is brand new, again, What to Expect When No One's Expecting. And so I want to just kick it off, Jonathan, by asking you, because here we are, we're talking to hundreds of thousands, actually, at this point, young adults who download this show, and most of them single. Most of them, I mean, we have talked here at Boundless about this whole delay of marriage and what that means, and we talk about it a lot personally because we have a lot of young adults who are frustrated, who say, I thought I'd be married at 22, but how come I just can't find someone? How come all these guys are weird? How come all these women are too picky? How come all these? And so they think of it in their own story and they're upset with where they are. But you are saying that this is really a result of a larger trend in society. And I think you illustrate a lot of that in the book. And so I want to just get you talking about when it comes to, I need you to explain, because I thought this was so great this morning when you talked about this whole idea of population control and this idea that, you know, the best thing we could ever have for our planet is to have fewer people on it, because otherwise we just, you won't have anything to eat and all this craziness. And you're saying, okay, so people believe that, but is that really the case? Is that really true? And then you actually shared an example of like where Japan, this has started trending in that direction. Can you kind of just explain that phenomenon and what we've actually found out as a result?
Yeah, so what we've been seeing over the last 40 years now is fertility rates falling first in the West, first in America and in the European countries, and then now around the world, so that 97% of the world's population lives in a country where the fertility rate is falling. And what this means is a lot of people have sort of in their popular imagination the idea that, you know, the world is bursting at the seams with people and that population globally is going to keep increasing and increasing and increasing. That's just not the case. All the models now suggest that world population is going to peak sometime in the next 50 or 60 years, somewhere around 9, maybe 10 billion, and then it's going to begin contracting. The real question is, how fast and how far does it tip backwards? Now, we've seen this before in history. This is not brand new. We've seen it a handful of times, and it has always been accompanied by very bad things, you know, political instability, social instability, economic stagnation, or worse. And so we see this beginning, you know, in Japan, you mentioned, Japan is the sort of the first country off the cliff here, and they are already losing population. In Japan last year, they sold more adult diapers than diapers for babies. And that's going to be like that from here on out to the horizon for Japan every year. If Japan's fertility rate were to recover magically tomorrow, then over the course of the next century, they would only lose 28% of their population. If it stays where it is now, they're going to lose 60% of their population. And it's going to be such that every year in Japan, just within the next 10 or 15 years, for every new birth you have, you're going to have somebody turning 100. So you'll have an equal number of like newborn infants and centenarians in the society, which has never happened before in the whole of human history. And it just becomes very difficult to predict what the social consequences of these sorts of changes are going to be.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we're seeing this, like you said earlier, we're seeing this globally in the sense of everyone can kind of pin it on, you know, people will say, oh yeah, we know about China and their one-child policy. We know about Scandinavia because they just don't want to have kids or whatever, but they're a small country, whatever. But now we're seeing, you're saying that even with what we're doing in the U.S. compared to China, talk a little bit about that, because we think, you know, well, we certainly haven't been mandating this. We don't have a one-child policy, but you're saying our rate isn't much different.
Not at all, in fact. You know, so when you think about the China one-child policy and I ask you what the Chinese fertility rate would be, most people would guess one because it makes sense, right? One. But that policy has a lot of loopholes. And so the average woman in China actually has 1.54 children over the course of her lifetime. Well, here in America, our fertility rate is 1.9, which isn't so bad. It's pretty good. But if you look at the middle class, just sort of normal middle class Americans, it's 1.6. So our middle class is only having 0.06 of a kid more than the Chinese are, except that they've been subjected to this horrible policy for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to, I think, just that big constellation of forces. You know, nobody's forcing us into this, but we're being nudged by all these little, you know, economic developments and cultural developments and social developments, all nudging us in the same direction.
Okay. So talk about the number 2.1. Why is 2.1 so important and why it's a good benchmark for us in understanding where we are in the U.S. and in the world and what that means for the future? Where we need to be.
So 2.1 is your golden number in the fertility rate. It's what they call the replacement level. If your fertility rate is above 2.1, then your population grows over time. If it is below 2.1, it contracts and shrinks over time. We have been below the 2.1 mark here in America since 1973. The entire Western world, with the exception of Israel, is below the 2.1 mark. And lots of places that you would not think are actually right around. Mexico is now just at 2.1 and their fertility rate is falling so fast that in 5 years they're going to be substantially below it. And so this is what's shaping everything here. Then globally, the fertility rate in the world in 1979 was 6. Today, just 35 years later or so, it's 2.5 and still falling. So the whole world is going to be below that 2.1 mark in probably the next 20 years or so.
Okay. So, I like what you talked about when we heard you this morning in this whole idea. I mean, there's kind of like, okay, there's those rates and we see that. Of course, we as single young adults often don't think in such a large perspective. And I like what you said about how we are a generation that's really living in the now, and how that in itself can be problematic because we're very much, and I see this, I mean, you actually painted a much kinder picture of us living in the now. I mean, I see us being a generation of really looking for personal fulfillment, looking for personal success, kind of entertaining ourselves to death in a sense, moving around in tribes, whether urban or otherwise. But what do you feel like, where have single young adults lost the vision for marriage and family? How has that come about? Has it been gradual or is there just something being perpetuated that's causing us to think less seriously about the ramifications as a result of, you know, dropping fertility rates?
You know, it's been gradual. So America has loved marriage historically. Mm-hmm. If you look at American marriage rates over time, they've always been fantastically high. We had a 50 or 60 year period where we didn't go below 97% of adults getting married at some point in their life. Mm-hmm. Now today we're down to about 90%. About 9 out of every 10 Americans gets married at some point. That's still actually quite high. And I think what it suggests is that it isn't that people have fallen out of love with the idea of marriage, but that it's just not working out for them. Now, I mean, there are really two views of, you know, what's going on with sort of that prolonged adolescence, right? And the first view is that it's all decadence, you know, people playing Xbox and people wanting to go out and hang out with their foodie friends and go to the dog park and do all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly true. There's some truth to it. But I think a lot of it also is a kind of fixation on the now that isn't decadence in any way. It's almost like hyper-responsibility. I mean, you think about people who all through high school, they work really hard, they don't party, they want to do well in the SATs, they want to go to a good college. And then they get to a good college and they want to work really hard and study hard so they can get into a good law school, you know. And then they become a lawyer and they decide, well, you know, well, now that I'm 25 and I'm a lawyer, I'm going to work really hard because I want to make partner. Well, now I'm 28 or 29 and I'm looking around and I would like to get married now. I feel like I'm, you know, I'm almost ready to buy a home and I could find a spouse. And then by the time you're ready to have like kids, you feel like you have done all the diligent things, like you're 37 and you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, you know, I've run out of time here. And so that is a fixation on the now, which isn't decadence in any way. It's almost like hyper responsibility. And that's a big part of it, I think. We've raised a generation of people who are so fixated on the present and planning that they are sort of not as open to serendipity and not really fixating on sort of duties to the past as well as hope for the future.
Mm-hmm. So you shared some examples of countries that have seen their populations drop and see this trend, how decisions they made maybe in the last generation aren't boding well for where they're going. And they're trying to either stem the tide or reverse it by enacting policies. And you're saying that many of them haven't worked. Can you give a couple examples of those just so people kind of understand and why haven't they worked?
Yeah, they don't work anywhere, truthfully. You know, you read a lot about Russia and what Russia has done. Russia has this huge public campaign trying to get people to get married earlier, get people to have babies. They've built these special couples benches for public parks in Moscow. And the benches are a little bit too short and they're sort of sloped on either side, sort of so that when you sit on them, but the people on either side are forced towards the middle to sort of encourage them to canoodle and get a little bit closer.
We need those here.
Yeah, and it doesn't work.
Boundless.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
Oh, okay.
I'm afraid to say. No. You know, in Singapore, they give giant cash payments to people who have kids. It's, I think, $10,000 for the first kid, $18,000 to have a second kid. They set up these little 401k savings accounts where the government matches your savings dollar for dollar for child care expenses. That hasn't worked there either. When you look at the literature, and there's a lot of, you know, academic research that's been done on pronatalist policy, and it suggests that it's very hard to move fertility rates anywhere but at the tiniest margins.
Hmm. Okay, so I find this fascinating because in light of that, you know, we would think that people aren't having kids because just no one wants kids anymore. You know, we're just too caught up in our lifestyles. We're afraid to get married, and there's some of that, and we've talked about that here at Boundless. But you're actually saying that we want, especially here in the U.S., we want the same number of kids as we did 40 years ago, I think you said. So how come we want the same things, but we're not seeing the same results? What's happening? Where's the disconnect?
Yeah, this is called ideal fertility, mm-hmm. and researchers measure the number of kids people say they want to have in a perfect world. And our ideal fertility here is 2.5. The average American will tell you they want 2.5 kids, which is actually really quite high. And so that suggests that, so what's going on here? This mm-hmm. big gap between our achieved fertility, the babies we do have, and the babies we want to have. And a lot of that, so when you watch that gap actually gets bigger the further up the education and income scale you get. And so what that's telling us is that the people who are spending the most time on their education, who are spending the most time on their jobs and really working hard at their careers, they're the ones who are falling the furthest short of their fertility ideals. And what that is all about, I think, is it's about delay. You know, so biology is not really very malleable. And so if you go to college, you graduate at 22 or 23, you go to graduate school of some sort, you get out of that by the time you're 25, 26, 27, you then don't get married until you're 28, 29. I mean, even if you're really focused on having a family, all of that sort of shrinks your window, and it begins then very, very hard to fit kids into it, because after 35, it gets a little bit harder to have kids. And by 39, it's really, really hard.
Hmm. Okay, so you also talk about something problematic, and I think I first read about this in your article. You actually wrote a cover story for the Weekly Standard called A Nation of Singles, and you talked about what you referred to as the Iron Triangle and how we have separated sex from marriage from having children, and how that has been problematic really in the attitudes towards marriage and family. Can you talk just a little bit about what that means and how it's specifically reflected in like millennials today?
Yeah. So if you go back to, let's just say 1960, you have this iron triangle, as I call it, linking sex, marriage, and childbearing. So you basically, it went like this. You couldn't have sex without getting married. You couldn't have sex without getting pregnant and having a baby. And you wouldn't have a baby without being married. You wouldn't do it out of wedlock. And so we then wind up with these technological and social developments where we have divorce law, we have cohabitation, we have the birth control pill and mastery of contraception, and we have the acceptance of illegitimacy and out-of-wedlock births. And all of these things happen within about a 15-year span between 1965 and 1980. And it breaks the Iron Triangle apart. Now, all of a sudden, you can have sex whenever you want. You don't need to be married. You can get married whenever you want. You can, without bothering to have sex. And you can have kids whether or not you're in a marriage. And so that breaks it apart. And the effect of this was actually to take those two central facts, sex and marriage, and the age of first sexual intercourse and the age of first marriage used to be very, very close together. And once this Iron Triangle broke apart, those two ages got pushed out to the margins. So people started having sex much, much earlier and then getting married much, much later.
Hmm. Okay, so one other thing I want to talk about from that article specifically was you wrote it post-election, where we were looking back at the election results, and you said really, you know, something that had been ignored probably demographically, or I guess when you look at demographics post-election, that's when everyone's like, oh, let's look at them for a span of about, what, 2 months maybe, or less. But you really talked about Hispanics being so important here in the U.S. as voters. And then you talked about what was very underreported was the influence of singles. And that's why the article was called A Nation of Singles. But how so many of them voted for Obama for various reasons, and how as a result, you know, you have probably Republicans kind of coming back and saying, oh, OK, well, we need to get these singles. Your argument is we need to get singles married, and that needs to be kind of the argument or the way that Republicans take it. Could you explain that a little bit? What do you think about that?
So we have this huge demographic gap in voting patterns between people who are married and people who are single. And so it winds up being a really strong predictor. If you show me, you know, tell me whether you're married or single, I can then guess pretty fair degree of confidence how you're going to wind up voting. Now, what I say is, you know, I try to sort of take the Republican Party to task and say, look, you know, the Republican Party right after the election was trying to figure out, well, how can we pander to singles too? We should be just as effective at pandering. What I say is, look, I have no great love for the Republican Party myself. They are what they are. But we ought not to be pandering to singles. What we ought to be doing is trying to get singles married. Just because objectively speaking, all of the outcomes are better for married people. People who are married are healthier, they live longer, they have higher incomes, they report being happier. And so, in truth, actually, this is all settled social science. And where the left used to push back on this, I mean, back in the 1970s, there was a lot of people, you know, people on the left side of the spectrum didn't want to admit that and they didn't want to talk about it. Today, it's totally accepted conventional wisdom that people who marry are much better off than people who cohabitate are much better off than people who are single. The outcomes are just better, just objectively speaking. And so I think actually there's some fertile political ground for the Republicans there, but that's actually incidental. I could care less about the Republican Party. I think it's good for America if we can help people get married. And again, it's not a question of like browbeating singles and telling, oh, you ought to get yourself married, you know, mm-hmm. youngin', because that's not it. It's about trying to find the ways that we have allowed modern life to get in the way of that marital fulfillment and try to pare it back. I mean, college is a big problem in all of this. You know, mm-hmm. we've sort of mandated college as part of like the middle class existence. And it winds up being enormously expensive. It delays the sort of the onset of adulthood by at least 4 years, in some cases, 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent that we could look at the college system and try to, you know, reform it so that everybody doesn't have to go. And if you go, you're not carrying around a giant debt load with you afterwards. You can start your adult life a little earlier. Again, it isn't that people don't want to get married and don't want families. They do. They just are finding that it's hard to get from point A to point B.
Yeah. And that's fascinating. And I think it is so true because it really is the mindset. Even when I was in college, which was a little bit ago now, but, you know, not too long ago. But it was very much that you are going to take this chunk out of your life and you are going to be this for 4 years. In many cases, 5, 6, 7 years, because it takes longer. People are paying their way through school or then they go on to graduate school, sometimes multiple graduate degrees because they don't know what they're doing. So, I mean, I think it is perpetuating exactly as you say. And it's this idea of you can't have this other life while you're in college. And I think you kind of, when you were speaking this morning, broke that bubble a little bit by saying, why not encourage marriage and childbearing within the college years? First of all, for the purpose of fertility and rates that are so much better than delaying into your 30s, for sure. And I think that's probably, apart from the Mormon church or that example, probably pretty countercultural or counterintuitive for many of us.
Yeah, it's super countercultural. Mm-hmm. I point point to BYU because BYU is an interesting case. They have special student housing for married students. A lot of students there are married. And at any given point in time, about 10% of the students at BYU, the undergraduates there, have kids. So there are like 3,000 babies running around that campus. And I think there's no reason why big state schools, why Ohio State's and Rutgers and UVA's the world, ought not to have a little bit of married student housing. Now, certainly not a lot of college undergraduates are going to want to start their families, but some of them probably are. Mm-hmm. And if you can sort of get that thin end of the wedge so that people can understand that the college experience can be both things, like it could be Animal House if you want it to be, or it could be Bleak House if you would rather start your family, then that's a good thing. And it begins changing in that small way people's perceptions about when adult life really begins.
So, Jonathan, with all of this research that you've done, everything that you've written, everyone that you've talked to, you know, talking here to an audience of single young adults who maybe some of them are like, well, I want to get married, but I'm not even sure if I can make it work. Some of them are like, I just can't find anyone halfway decent. What do they need to know? I mean, what is the most compelling thing that you could say to them to kind of turn the tide of thinking towards looking to the future, looking to the past? I know you're very passionate about that, about having that whole perspective on life and culture. What's the most compelling thing that they need to know to understand what this means for them and what this means for society as a whole?
You know, what I say is, I always tell people, you should, this isn't about settling. This isn't about like just forging ahead and, you know, well, you find a place and you plant a flag and go for it. What you should be doing is looking for the person that you want to spend the rest of your life with. And that person is hopefully out there. And for some people, it's not. For some people, it's hard. God knows, my little sister, my baby sister, didn't get married until she was 32. But she found the perfect guy, the guy who she was absolutely meant for. And I'm so happy for her. And it's going to be great. They're going to have a great life together. And so for the people who it takes a little longer and it's sort of, you know, it's a winding road, that's fine. What I always try to say for everybody else, just live with intent. You know, the real lesson that I took from writing this book was that we had sort of backed ourselves into this cul-de-sac in America without really thinking about it too hard. You know, we had changed divorce laws without thinking about it. We had changed the patterns of life without thinking about it. And we just sort of looked up one day and realized, gosh, we're not having enough babies. This is going to be a problem. To the extent that we just do things with intent, live intentionally, and just, you know, when you're in college, when you're 22, when you're 23, it doesn't mean you got to like get married right away, but look around you and engage with the world seriously and be open to those things. Because I think that's how life really takes care of itself.
Absolutely. Well, what kind of last question here? What would you say then is, because we haven't talked a lot about responsibility in this, what is the family's responsibility? And I mean, parents of young adults, that larger family community, what is the church's responsibility in helping young adults move in that direction? Because I think there are probably, you know, thousands of single women listening right now who are like, okay, seriously, Jonathan, I am trying. But I just,
My sister's one of them. I'm with you guys.
I hit 30 and I'm not married and I don't know what to do. What else can I do? I've tried online dating. I've tried this, but it's just, I'm stuck in a generation where this is not happening. And I feel like I'm ready to just throw up my hands and say, forget it.
And you don't. You keep plugging away. And, you know, this is... You know, the duty of family extends beyond like when the kid is 18 and moves out of the house. And this is, you know, when you're 30, your parents still have an obligation to you. They should be, still be, you know, there helping you and helping you through it in different ways because you're now adults. You're more co-equal than you were as a kid. And this is what churches are for. Churches are for, you know, not trying to like matchmaker or anything like that, but establishing a community of people where just get a peer group of people who are all, you know, who you have the same values and they think the same way. And, you know, once you sort of get into that world and have those people to swim with, it can just make it a little easier. And really, again, I am not trying to like, you know, chastise people who aren't married and tell them not to, because I really feel like everybody should wait until they find the perfect person. Marriage is the greatest thing in the universe. Like, really, I can't even tell you how happy I am in my marriage. But I can see real quick how awful marriage could be if you're married to the wrong person. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, do things with intent. Think seriously about it, because it's for forever. It's for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be good. You just got to get yourself there.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. Again, we've been discussing research and findings and just cultural patterns that are revealed in his book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. And really great things to think about. This is the kind of thing that you want to sit down, grab a group of your friends, go out for coffee and talk about this and what it means. Like, what does this mean for you personally? What does it mean as you look at your family and your extended, you know, your relationships with others, your community, and then what it means for our future? I mean, I know I've just been talking with with friends recently about our fears about who is going to be there for us when we're old. I mean, I am single, you know, I will be aging, and I'm like, do I need to just become my nieces and nephews' best friends so they take care of me? I mean, there are implications for this. And so I think that's huge. And I think it's something that we need to look at seriously and see what our part is in that. So start the conversation, folks. Jonathan Lass, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Thanks so much for being part of this.
Thank you. And this is all my hope and peace, nothing but the blood of Jesus. And this is all my righteousness, nothing but the blood of Jesus. And oh, precious is the flow that makes me white as snow.
Hey folks, we are opening up this week's inbox, and we have a fun face here in the studio with me, Jackson Dunn. Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. So Jackson is our director of marriage here at Focus on the Family. He himself is married, so we thought he would be a good candidate for this question. We like it when we can get some new blood in here and some new perspectives. So I'm very fascinated to hear what his response will be to this. So our listener says, what if I already know I won't enjoy sharing a bed with my husband when I get married? I really value getting my good night's sleep, and the thought of being woken up more than a few times by someone else tossing and turning, stealing the covers, or worse, snoring, is something that I'm really dreading. I've been sleeping in a bed by myself for 23 years. What can I do to mitigate my fears and deal with the issues when they do arise?
That is a good question. Mm-hmm. And as odd as it may sound, this actually is a pretty normal fear. Mm-hmm. There's a new normal that we're going to experience in marriage. And again, it may sound a little silly, or how can you know you're not going to enjoy being in the bed with your husband? 23 years in my own bed. That really is a pretty normal fear because of what has led up to this point in your marriage. But here's what I want to say. First of all, I encourage newlyweds to share a bed with their spouse. Mm-hmm. So let's make that clear.
Okay.
But I think we can also practically look at this. Okay, so there is the new normal. I think so many of these fears, once you actually are married, you're sharing the home, you're sharing the bed, you're sharing your space. So many of those things kind of are mitigated just by the fact that you get to be together. So there's kind of the theoretical aspect of this, her question, but I want to get real practical here. There are some things you can do to actually, she said, how can I mitigate fear, but also when those things come up? You know what? Get a really nice king-size bed, the memory foam. You know the whole commercials, you drop the bowling ball, the mm-hmm. glass of wine.
And the other person doesn't move.
Exactly.
That's good.
Honestly, get one of those. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Like even my wife and I, she wears earplugs to bed. A noisemaker. We've got a humidifier that creates some noise. Like you can actually practically create some of those distractions, diversion, noises, whatever it is that kind of wakes you up. You can do that and probably, for the most part, eliminate this problem for her. And if it does come up and those things aren't working, talk about that. Mm-hmm. What is the routine? How has the sleeping going? Are there things? I wouldn't want this to something to be buried. I don't want this to be a fear that's going to overwhelm or consume leading into. I think we've got to take a deep breath about that and allow that to be a part of the process of adjustment. Mm-hmm. But then again, really getting practical with this and addressing, talking about it as you go.
Yeah. Well, it seems interesting because I think there really is some validity to understanding that there is a period of adjustment. Because I remember when one of my friends got married, she, like those first 3 months, she was like, yeah, I'm just not getting really good sleep because I'm getting used to this whole thing. And I had never thought of that before, you know, because obviously Hollywood doesn't paint that picture, you know, it's just all good all the time.
Yes.
So she was like, yeah, this takes some getting used to, just our schedules, the way that he sleeps, the way who likes it a little bit lighter, who likes it darker, who needs a shirt over the alarm clock because they can't deal with the display, all that kind of stuff. And I know, even myself, man, when I travel with girlfriends and we go on a trip, I have had to wear earplugs because snoring, like, that's legit, man. That is like, so like you're saying, I mean, I think that makes a big difference. And so, so you're saying Krista wears earplugs. Is
she
that because you're a snorer?
No, she, well, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
No, no.
Oh, she just has to wear, oh, that's sad.
What's funny, okay. she just said always, you know, she grew up doing that. I mean, she was on the mission field and different stuff. And so just of her way, she's a pretty light sleeper. So she's found her ways to adjust. And I thought it was really weird that she did when we first got married. I'm like, but I don't think I saw what it, it was just part of her routine. Mm-hmm. And so it might be establishing a new routine. But I want to, something you said about your friend, and this is, I think, one of the keys to a successful first year of marriage, those first few months even, are realistic expectations. Mm-hmm. What you described was your friend almost expected there to be adjustments. Mm-hmm. If you can walk into this, go, okay, I might not sleep real well this first part. Did I marry the wrong person or am I never going to be able to share a bed with this person? No. Right. There will be a new routine. You will adjust. If you can expect, and you named the whole laundry list of getting ready in the morning, the routine, the bathroom, the toothbrush, all those kind of things. If you can expect there to be an adjustment and extend grace, assume the best. No one wants to keep you up all night. No one wants to mess up your morning routine. You're just figuring out. But you know what? It is such a cool, fun adventure because you and your spouse, you are defining it every single day. Yeah. Like you get to do that. You get to do that together. It's not something you have to adjust to.
Right. Cool. Well, great thoughts, Jackson. Thanks for weighing in on that. And if you guys have any additional thoughts, please do throw them out on the blog for us, especially those of you who are newlyweds. Weigh in as to how you have made those adjustments, because I know many of you are still in the listening audience, so we want to hear from you. So very cool. Thanks so much, Jackson.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, that is it for this week's show. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can answer your question on a future show. Of course, we have our advice section right on our homepage now, so you can click on that anytime and search for a past topic, because chances are we've probably addressed a question or more that you are thinking of even right now. Until next week, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.